still watching the Olympics? I know you are. It's very easy to see what's going on. It's movement. But is it possibility? If you want to tune into the land of infinite possibility, a place where you don't dare look unless you're here right now, you're tuned in to your unconscious mind's favorite late night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Hello, good day, everyone. Good day. Greg Bornstein, your host here with Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. I, of course, am your consciousness disruptor, your curator of experience, and of course, your cultural hypnotist. Put all those things together, you get a looper. And of course, well, some of you might be listening to this for the first time. Some of you might not be listening to this for the first time. And some of you, most of you, aren't listening to this at all. Person sitting next to you, I'm actually talking to them as well as you as your headphones are in. Hey, you not listening. Listen. Now look, what exactly is an open loop? What are we talking about on this show? What the heck? I'll get to that in a second. You see, my goal is to challenge your existing belief systems by sharing with guests radically unique ideas designed to stimulate your unconscious mind so you're forced to step into the highest version of yourself. We do that in many ways on this show. We're discussing some really out there topics. Aliens. Generally, the paranormal, I guess you could put that under the category of the magical, the mysterious, the esoteric, the metaphysical, the philosophical, the psychological, the escapist, the psychoanalytical, topics that force us to delve into areas that we don't normally talk about in waking reality, unless you're a very particular kind of person. And to me, what's most interesting about this sort of thing is that these topics are provocative. They are designed to provoke your full mind, your unconscious, subconscious, out of conscious awareness, and really engage with reality in a different way. See, that's what an open loop is. It's starting something but not finishing. Like what I did at the beginning, what is an open loop? Didn't answer the question, made you wonder, talked about a whole bunch of other stuff, and then finished the loop by explaining what it is right now. But also, see, there I did it again. Now, sometimes open loops are just dead ends. People just open up ideas. You'll see this all the time in ads, right? They'll say, I'm going to tell you three secrets to get that beach body. And then they'll never actually tell you the three secrets. They'll just pitch the course. But now you think there are three secrets. It's a technique. Now, of course, this show is all about loops and keeping loops open and provoking new loops to open up. And my guest today has been, well, I guess in the loopiest of loopy professions. The circus, but also Broadway, but also a fish concert at Madison Square Garden. He's also a comedian. He's also now an author. Multiple books, actually. This new one, which is very fun, hashtag shit my mama says, really just, well, I'll let you listen in and hear my guest, Bobby Hedgeland Taylor, talk all about it. Yes, now this is another guest here on Open Loops that isn't fringe, I would say, in the traditional sense, right? We're not talking about psychics and manifestation, numerology, deep hypnotherapy. We're not going there. But what we are doing is we're examining what's really happening behind the veil of show business. That was one of my original intentions with starting this show. It's going, okay, let's look at the fantastical and what makes the fantastical work behind the scenes. Interestingly enough, I put out this episode very close to when I did the one with Saul Blinkoff, who is the animator, worked for Disney in deconstructing a lot of the things that Disney does. I think listening to this episode in parallel with that one, it shows you that there's a lot of carryover in terms of what makes powerful entertainment resonate with people for years to come. Yes, we get into Spider-Man and why that was a flop, and also the commercial empire of Cirque du Soleil, and Bobby's thoughts on that, and Bobby's experience in reality television, and there's some nice little tidbits here that you're not going to hear anywhere else from somebody that's actually been in the business. Bobby's done everything in showbiz. I mean, really, a consummate professional, and when he met physical circumstances that forced him not to be able to hang from ribbons and do tightrope walking and all the stuff that he used to do, well, you'll learn about his thought process in terms of how to make the most engaging and still theatrically engaging life despite not doing everything he was up to all those years. It's a fantastic conversation. It's a wonderful tribute to his mom as well. And I really enjoyed just sitting in and listening to Bobby reflect on his life and how you all as well, despite your circumstances, can artfully still make meaning. If you enjoy Open Loops, please make sure to follow this podcast. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please, if you could rate the show and leave a review, it definitely helps get this content out there. Looking to inspire hope in someone, hey, share this episode. This is a great one to share because I really think Bobby's tale deeply resonates. I mean, this is an entertainer through and through, so it's not a boring conversation. It's great. Tell that to the person sitting next to you, too, who is not listening to the show currently. Hey, this is an entertaining one. You should listen. Never know. That's, at the very least, you started the conversation with someone in person, so hey, no one talks to strangers anymore. All right, everyone. Here we go. I hope you enjoy Bobby Hedgeland Taylor. Bobby Hedgeland Taylor joins me today on Open Loops. Yes, Bobby is, somebody called him a multi-hyphenated artist, and that is so true. Former aerialist, actor, dancer, circus sequence designer. He's really, you've really done it all, Bobby. And now you're an author of a new work, hashtag shit my mama says. We're going to go into all of that. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm excited to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. You know, I'm happy to share my story. So
yeah. You know, initially, this is what I was curious about. I know that you came, I put this prompt out there for the kind of guests I was looking for, people that could really shift my perspective on the way reality works. That's the nature of this show. And I mean, to me, going into showbiz and studying acting like I did, and very much participating in other pieces of theater was my early way of doing it, trying to go into a different reality. But I'm curious, since you responded to the prompt, I mean, what was it that spoke to you about the idea of shifting reality and that made you intrigued enough to want to have this conversation?
Well, absolutely. Well, I usually call them pivots. Life gives us life. You know, people say life gives you lemons, make lemonade. I say bullshit. Life gives you lemons, make a lemon chiffon, limoncello,
yes.
tiramisu, you know, and,
yes.
and then, you know, make yourself a cocktail with the limoncello, you know,
perfect.
So what happened? So about 6 years ago, my mother moved in with me, and that was a pivot because I had to then take on, you know, the caregiver, aspect of having an elderly relative. And then, 3 months ago, I had another pivot happen, because I'm a movement specialist. The one thing that I have used the most is my body, and yeah. I had a hip replacement, because, just rheumatoid arthritis is starting to ravage my joints. You know, aerial acrobatics, you know, falling to a net or an airbag or hanging off of stuff for 30 plus years, your body is like, hey, excuse me, you only get a certain amount of use out of this before it starts to go.
Right.
And
right.
So I got a flat tire and the doctor fixed it. And now I'm walking about 3 miles a day, and I'm approved to ride a bike. And no racquetball or tennis yet, but I'm sure that'll change soon. But you know that they're pivots, and it's how fast you can pivot, how fast you can recover. And one of the things when I teach and coach acrobatics, one of the apparatus that I'm very fortunate to have learned was tight wire. And on a tight wire, what's the thing your body's trying to do? Stay on it, obviously, but you're always falling. So how do you adjust your body weight and shift small amounts of body weight from either side of the wire to stay centered? And that is how I live my life. You know, I have to stay centered, and you're always broke. You know, so it's about a shift. It's about a pivot. And what spoke to me so much about that was that it was the ease in which you require, you know, because when people post about, you know, they're looking for podcast guests or they're looking for someone to do an interview. A lot of times it's way too heady and way too, you know, esoteric or ethereal in their description. And yours is pretty like, hey, I just want somebody who's going to change my mind. And in that simplicity, I'm like, dude, let's talk. The thing is that a lot of people believe in, they believe that they don't have the power to make these shifts, or they don't have the money, or they don't have the ability, or they don't have the drive. And I say bullshit. And I say bullshit because I can, you know, I can do anything. And I knew, and the thing is, I never had that kind of an attitude about life until fairly recently. Because when you don't know if you're going to wake up the next day, because I was telling you earlier, my mother died in March of 2020, and we believe it was from COVID. And then the next day I woke up with COVID. And so when you're not sure, when you're watching people die all around you, and I lost a lot of people, I lost about 6 relatives, 3 to COVID, 3 to other diseases and things like that happened, but 6 relatives in the course of the pandemic, as well as 17 friends.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry to hear that. My gosh.
With that much debt, and I live in Queens, New York, which was the epicenter of the outbreak. So when you have an ambulance passing your house every 20 minutes with the siren going, you tend to think, is it my time? And I knew it wasn't my time, but it was a matter of, okay, focus. What do you do to get healthy? What do you do to stay awake? What do you do to go to sleep? What, you know, how do you navigate this new world in this, with this unforeseen evil that was everywhere? And I pivoted. And there was a moment where I, because they weren't letting anybody in to the emergency room or an urgent care unless you were critical. So you could walk over there and you say, I'm sick, I think I have COVID. They're like, go home, go home, come back when you're critical. And so I knew then that I was like, oh, I guess I'm not critical. And I was vague booking a lot at that moment because I didn't want to cause any kind of hysteria with my friends or anything like that. Plus, I just didn't know publicly what I wanted to announce to the world, just because we just weren't sure what was going on with this disease. And so a friend noticed and she said, something's up. I know your mom just passed, but this isn't like you. And I said, yeah, I have COVID. And she said, what's your mailing address? I sent her, gave her my mailing address. And 2 days later, a box arrives. And in that box were these herbal remedies and herbal liquids and tinctures. And they were all to boost the immune system. And I started those. And within 3 days, no headaches, no fevers. I started to feel better. I started to breathe easier. I was able to walk a little bit more. I had COVID for about 6 weeks. And this was right around the midpoint. So whether they were placebo or whether the virus had worked itself out of my body, but I got better. And and then I paid it forward whenever somebody told me that they were sick. I went to this herbal farm online, Tweefontaine Farm. And I'm not a shareholder or anything, but
yeah,
I do believe that the herbs did something to my immune system to help me fight the virus. And every single person that I sent those herbs to recovered. And I just think that there are moments when you realize that there's something bigger than yourself out there. And I wasn't ready to go. I'm still not ready to go. I won't be ready to go for a long time.
Yeah. When you said something that stuck out to me in this, Bobby, was when you said, I believe I can do anything. I imagine that somebody that goes into being an aerial performer, an actor and dancer, and does that full time already has some level of that mindset. When you went into showbiz initially, and really we're talking physicalized show business, mm-hmm. I mean, really putting yourself out there, what was your mindset back then if it wasn't the I can do anything mindset?
It was similar to the I can do anything mindset. I was the first one in my family to go to college and the first one to see. So I was born and raised in Pennsylvania on a mountaintop.
Hmm.
And my great grandfather and grandfather bought plots of land on this mountaintop. And then my great grandfather had 13 children. And each one of his 13 children and their family settled around him. So the top of the mountain was this Italian Iannisport. We're all Sicilian. And so that was my sort of microcosm. It was this little bubble that I grew up in. And so I knew that there was life outside of that bubble. And I knew that there were, and I had been coming to New York since I was a kid, from school trips to visiting my cousin in New Jersey, and we would just sneak over the George Washington Bridge and go see Broadway shows, go to the museums. And I knew it's at 10 years old, I knew I wanted to live here. I knew at 3 years old, I wanted to be an actor. And I remember watching TV, and I know it was 3 years old because it was in our first house before we moved on the hill. Where we moved on the hill when I was 4 years old. So I remember watching TV and I remember seeing it. And then it wasn't until I saw in the 70s, seeing John Travolta dancing and singing and things like that. And like, wow, this is a dude. This isn't like, you know, so yes. In my mind, it wasn't a feminine thing that I could be ashamed of. You know, dancing was, he made it a masculine thing in the movie. And the same thing with West Side Story. That was like the movie of West Side Story was what I remember seeing when I was 3 years old. So I knew I wanted to be in the performing arts. I just didn't know what or how it was going to happen. And all through high school, I didn't do any theater or anything like that. I was so shy. I was painfully shy. In fact, I wrote two books during the pandemic. The first book was a cookbook called Escape to Ravioli Mountain, a memoir in food. The mountain that I grew up on got the derogatory nickname Ravioli Mountain because we were Sicilian and we were all related. And so I was like, I spun it and I took all the recipes and stories from the mountain. But my first words are, my mother told me my first words were fucking reindeer. And so I was like, yeah. So I was like, Mom, can you elaborate? And so this was one of the visits to the emergency room that we had in January or February. She was still in the nursing home. And she was bouncing back and forth between the nursing home and the ER because she was having different issues. She was falling. She had gastric issues. She had coughing, respiratory issues. So they just couldn't figure out what was going on in February. And so we'd sit there sometimes for 18 hours. I would sit there with her because she had dementia. And so we would sit there and talk. And I was like, and she, you know, she would just throw things out there. And that's when I started writing down her shit my mama says a little bit more intensely to make sure that I had them in my head. But that's when I started writing the cookbook. And my first words, very simple story. It was Christmas time, and my mom bought these two inflatable reindeer and put them by the Christmas tree. And my brother and I are toddlers. And of course we start playing with them and we break one. And then we start playing with the other one and start fighting over it. My mother comes into the living room like a ninja with a wooden spoon and was like, give me that fucking reindeer, and threw it in the closet. Well, my grandmother comes over for dinner that night. We hear the car door slam. We hear her come to the front door. We run to the door. And in my little year and a half old mind, I'm like, my grandmother's going to give me my reindeer. And I grabbed her skirt and I yelled and I'm like, Nana, Nana, fucking reindeer, pointing to the closet, fucking reindeer. So when I was like, this is gold, this is comedy gold. And
it really,
you know,
is.
And it was like, I can't, you know, there's no other way to explain it other than divine intervention was like, now you need to start doing this. Now you're sitting in the emergency room with your mother, who's probably, you know, you never think that it's going to be time for your mom, you know, because she was rebounding from everything. She would be down for the count for 2 days and then like a ninja back up again. And then it was just after the pandemic started, the last time I saw her was the day after she was in the ER. I stopped by about 30-minute visit on March 10th. And then on March 11th, they shut down visitations to the nursing home. So I didn't see her again until we would FaceTime every day, and then even the day before, you know, I FaceTimed her. So, but as far as that goes, like that upbringing, you're surrounded by people who are general laborers, people who work as construction workers. Someone's a junk salesman. Someone works in a restaurant. Pizzeria, you know, you're not surrounded. I wasn't surrounded by Rhodes scholars. So it's not, and that's not a bad thing. I'm nothing derogatory about my family and upbringing. I mean, these were hardworking people, which is where I got my ethic. But I just felt that I wanted so much more, you know. It was very much like insert Disney song here, you know, like Hercules, Little Mermaid, you know, that I want song from Disney. So I got I had started in the Stroudsburg Ballet Theater in Pennsylvania, and I got a full scholarship there as a ballroom dancer. Not because I was good at dance, but because they needed men, and they needed men who could lift girls, and they needed men who wanted to dance. And I thought at that point, you know, like I was saying, the masculinity that was coming through dance at that moment, ballroom dancing was a way that you could still dance and not be, you know, called, you know, whatever derogatory word they were calling gay people at the time. So, you know, so it was my way of sort of easing into it, sort of hiding my homosexuality. You know, I have to come out. Hello, big deal. You know, flashcards, you know, but it was a way to embrace the arts. And so then I got a full scholarship to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy in New York. And that's when I really started to, because I'd done small things, summer stock theater, things like that, you know, the local production of The Music Man kind of stuff.
Yes, yes.
But it wasn't until I came to New York and actually, you know, got to school and was like, oh, there's a science to auditioning. There's a science to navigating the entertainment industry. And I did what every other kid did. I went through 2 years of that training And then 6 months after that, I joined the circus because it was just because it was there. And it was just it was theatrical. It came through a theater gig. I was a good friend of mine who when we met, I was bartending at a bar down in the village. And he was like, I want you to sing for a role in this show I'm doing. And it was The Circus Adventures of Toby Tyler, which is an old Disney film from 1960.
Yeah, I remember watching that as a kid.
They were doing a live version of it, and they needed someone who was, you know, young, redheaded, could sing, act, dance, and do circus stuff. Well, I could do everything except the circus stuff. So they sent me to a Ukrainian Olympian, Irina Gold. She was the only trapeze coach in New York City, and there were only six students that she took on, myself and five ladies. And so within 6 months after training with her, I started to get work, but as a trapeze artist. And then that trapeze work ended up on my resume. So I'd get into theater stuff, and then they'd scroll down to my special skills and like, oh, trapeze. What's that all about? And then I'd get an extra 3 to 5 minutes in the room with the casting director and the director. Didn't always book the gig, but something set me apart from the other like 700 people that were in the waiting room that had red hair, green eyes, could dance, act, and sing, you know, all that stuff. So the circus stuff really set me apart. And at that time, circus was really paying really well. So you could get a gig as a solo trapeze artist and make your rent in one weekend. And I used to do the nightclub scene here. So we had Shine, Club ABC, Palladium, Limelight, and then Webster Hall, all these big they were old banks and theaters and things like that that were converted to nightclubs. So the rigging was very simple. We could rig to the ceiling and then we'd perform. Most of the ladies got most of the work because nightclubs wanted something pretty to look at.
Right.
So I had to wait my turn, which is another theory in my life because I have to wait my turn for a lot of things. But I had to wait my turn to get chosen because they wanted the girls. And no offense to them. It was just, that was the gig. And when they realized, oh, it doesn't matter your gender in the air. And I was like, yeah, you know, and so I started to work at other clubs and things like that. So most of the 90s, I didn't do a lot of the big shows or a lot of the tours. I did, you know, I did a magic show tour, and then I did a small, what we call a mud show, which is a small one ring circus that travels through the southern states. They call it a mud show because you usually set up the tent in a park, and then as soon as it rains, everything's muddy. So you're always walking around with your we always had clogs backstage because you're just we had animal, you know, back then the animals were in the circus and stuff like that. So I never really cut my teeth in the circus world, more the nightclub world. And again, a pivot. But the entertainment industry was still there, and I was still doing theater in between gigs. And then when I wasn't doing either, I was bartending. And bartending in itself is an art. It's an art to be able to measure a drink without using now everybody uses measuring spoons and things like that. We never did that. It was a very simple count and pour, and you knew exactly how much liquor was in there and in the cocktail. So that became a new art form. And in the same way that I pivoted during the pandemic to change my art from physical to writing, it was just changing. You're still turning the page when you watch a theater show. It's just done with acting. The same way that I do aerial sequence design is when something in the show requires somebody to be flown across the stage, like Peter Pan or Tarzan, take those two things. Or something like I did on Broadway called Pippin, in which we had, the show was about a traveling circus.
Yeah.
So we had all these circus performers, and I got to train Andrea Martin and Patina Miller for their lead roles. They both won Tony Awards. I also trained Rob McClure how to walk a tightrope in the musical Chaplin. And I was also an aerial trainer on the musical called The Frogs about the River Styx. So I got called in for these different shows where my expertise was to, how do we turn the page by showing somebody flying across the stage? What does that do to the story? So in Tarzan, there's a song called Son of Man, where Tarzan starts out as a little boy, and at the end of the song, he has to be a grown-up man. So what we did is we had Tarzan fly across the stage, and then from the back of the house, on a rope, big Tarzan flew in onto the stage. And that design I learned from the amazing Paul Rubin, who is one of the best fly designers out there. But it's how it's instead of it being gratuitous of like, oh, somebody's being pulled up by strings or by a cable, or somebody's climbing a rope, it told the story. It turned the page. Tarzan got older. In that 1.5 minutes of the end of the song, he grew up. So that's the kind of stuff that I learned how to do by taking my circus and theater work and put them together.
So this is, and this is what I find interesting is that it seems as if you consistently were thrown different situations in different circumstances. And I feel that in such a high stress level profession, that's the thing you always hear, right? In mm-hmm. acting school, I always heard, if you can do any other profession except be an actor, do that. If there's anything else that would make you happy, do that. And what that told me, at least that was a story that they were telling me at the time. Now, I even question that story now.
Oh, absolutely.
I question a lot of the thing these acting teachers. Yeah, actually, let's start there. What is your response to that common
Absolutely.
Axiom?
I know exactly. So here's the thing. Most of the time when I was going to acting school, you're trained by somebody who's not a professional actor or who's not working. A lot of times they're either not working for many reasons. They're either not, they were either taking time off, or they're not getting work, which was most of the people that I was training with,
right.
or they're career acting teachers who've never worked professionally. And I found that that was one of the biggest mistakes of my career. It's like, how are you supposed to teach me how to work and get work in the acting industry if you're not working yourself? And there were some bigwigs that taught me in my school, and they weren't there very long. And that was one of the things I noticed that, and it's not, I'm not saying anything bad about my school. I went to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, and I had a great education. It got me to New York. It gave me the tool belt to get out there. But also you have to keep re-upping your tool belt, because I went to theater school in the 80s. All the Andrew Lloyd Webber shows were popular in the 80s. So everybody was auditioning differently. Then in the 90s, it shifted. Everything became Rent. Everything became this new pop rock kind of a sound. And everybody was clenching their fists and screaming notes.
Yes.
And then, you know, then the 2000s happened. So each decade of musical theater changes, as does the acting style. But I found through all of that, that you want, when somebody says to you, don't do it, that means they're afraid of it. And that to me would, if any of my teachers said that to me, I'd be like, bullshit, you shouldn't be teaching me. If you're telling me that, if you're telling me to quit, then you shouldn't be teaching me. And I was very, very adamant about making sure that I did not have something to fall back on, because I knew if I had something to fall back on, I'm just going to fall back on it. And I'm not going to attack this goal head on. There's a great book by Napoleon Hill, and it was given to me when I was in Boy Scouts, and it's called Think and Grow Rich. Now, I'm not rich. First of all, you know, I have a $2 fan on the wall from Chinatown, and,
right.
and a bunch of books. I'm not rich. And, you know, but the way that your mind shifts, and you have to attack everything with the same intensity. And when you set a goal for yourself, look at how you start to go towards it. If I didn't set a goal that I needed my mother's book to be done before August 1st, I would still have that book. I wouldn't have it published. My mother's birthday is August 7th. She would have been 85 years old this year. On August 14th is her funeral and memorial service for the people that passed, because I wanted a family reunion. And I wanted to memorialize my mother, her two sisters, and their husbands and the people we lost during the pandemic. And if I didn't set that goal, I would have not sat down at the computer and, you know, edited, looking at every single page. And I'm not an editor, I'm not a writer, and I'm not a chef, but I wrote a cookbook and I wrote a book of quotes memorializing my mother. So for me to, and I'm the king of the run-on sentence, if you haven't noticed.
No, but it's good. You're a great storyteller. I'm pulled into it.
See, that's the thing, though, that if I were to sit back and just say, okay, I want to do this offbeat thing, there's no drive there. There's no fire. When I moved to New York, I came here with $35 in my pocket. I got a full scholarship to a school. And my parents and my grandmother did not want anything to do with me going to acting school. My grandmother was like, oh, you're going to acting school? Why don't you go for computers? Computers are gonna be big. And I'm like, Grandma, you know, this is a chance. I'm getting a full scholarship. They're paying for it. And, you know, she was right, because computers are huge. And if I actually had the drive to be a computer technician, I would have been a computer technician. Yeah. But I had the bug. There's one thing I say, that the one thing that is like heroin to me, the one thing that is the most addictive thing in the world, is making people laugh, knowing people are laughing because of something you said or did. There's nothing more addictive than that sound of those applause. And I can't with good conscience not say that is my heroin. That is that's crack. You know, when I hear an audience laugh because I do a song in stand-up, I do a song, the song Let It Go from Frozen.
Yeah.
But I do it as 14 different characters, starting with Eric Cartman from South Park. And as soon as I start singing as Eric Cartman, the audience loses their shit, and there is nothing more addictive. That Eartha Kitt's voice comes out of me in the middle of the song. People go nuts for that. When they hear that familiarity, I give them permission to laugh. And the laughter is like what feeds me when it comes to those things. But when it comes down to theater school and somebody teaching you, they should be teaching you how to work. Acting is a business. Theater is a business. So you have to not only have your business cap on, you have to know this is the technique to do what I need to do. If it's an aerial sequence design, what's the scene? And what am I doing with this aerial apparatus, with this actor or actress? What am I trying to achieve? And then if it's a regular scene, what's the actor there to do? If I'm in a scene with you, if I'm doing this, what is that character? You don't have to go through all that heavy bullshit that the old acting schools put on you. What is your motivation? Where are you coming from? What's his 24-hour life? Bullshit. Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. Just,
yeah.
What is the actor, what is the character there to do? Do. Acting is doing. Simple. Cut it. Take all that heady shit out. And then listen to the guidance by the director. Now, I've worked with some directors who are absolutely brilliant. Diane Paulus, genius, absolute genius.
Yes.
Warren Carlyle, brilliant choreographer and director. Joanne Hunter, you know, these people have the detail-oriented eyes. If you go on stage and there's a detail that the audience picks up, then you're not doing your full job. So if the audience picks up a detail that's missing, or that there's something about what you're wearing, the clothes don't match the time period, I my skin crawls when I watch people who are staging shows and they're wearing modern clothing and it's supposed to be the 1950s or something like someone did not take the time to really look at the cut of the clothing of that time period. It takes me right out of it, because my mind is, you're supposed to be depicting, say, the 50s or 60s. And right now I see, you know, lucky jeans from 2010, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm like, why they didn't even exist in the 1950s. Why are you putting this person in there? You know, there's very,
are you saying this happens in professional theaters?
Absolutely.
You still see people
still
make these errors? Wow.
They still do it. And that's why, and a lot of shows don't succeed, because they're the details that aren't in the devil is in the details. You've got to have those tiny little pristine moments that bring you to, the time period. And that's just one thing. I mean, it depends on the style of the acting, the style of the communication.
Was that something that you naturally had a gift for going that detailed, or is that something you honed over time?
I really had to do my homework. When I knew I was going to theater school, I rented what we had videotapes back then. I don't know if you remember.
Yes.
But I rented every musical, and I literally would watch it over and over again. I rented every classic musical that I could get a hold of, and then there are incredible details in those old movies because they're there for a reason, and they're classics for a reason. Fiddler on the Roof, Hello Dolly, Funny Girl, Music Man. They all have, even Godspell from that kitschy version of the musical from 1970s.
Yes.
They still have, it's as if you're looking through a camera lens all the time. And it's the way that I've always designed my work. If I have questions, then the audience is going to have questions. If I say, why is this girl getting onto this apparatus right now? And you don't have an answer for me. That's the problem that we have to solve, because then you're not turning the page. Then you're just doing something gratuitous. And I find that I really had to learn that details really shine. Even, you know, like the musical Wicked is one of my favorites. And I got to go backstage a couple times, and the costuming in Wicked is so detailed and so finite in the way that they are created that there's trim on some of the costumes, and the trim is gold, and it has the word Oz, and it's just a string of the word Oz going up the coat.
Oh,
and
man,
that fine detail does you would never see it, but you see the elegant costume on the stage, and the whole stage lights up because the entire thing is one person's concept. And when I coach, like I was doing a cruise ship, several cruise ships a few years ago, they asked me to do a couple of numbers for the show. And one of them was Unchained Melody, and they wanted an aerial duet. And my aunt had just passed, and my aunt was a dancer in the USO. She was a tap dancer. So I created that aerial duet about my aunt, and it was very simple. And I told the two performers, I said, okay, the audience is not going to know any of this, but I want you to have in your head every time you do this performance that she's going to die and you are helping her into heaven. And that's the man's job in the duet. And the woman, you're supposed to, and you are the dancer, you're floating up to heaven. So I want you to show that. It didn't have to be anything more than those two things. And then I told them, you give me four different sections of this piece. I want you to think about your father, your mother, best day of your life, worst day of your life. And I want you to mix up all four of those in every emotional change of this piece. It's a cruise ship.
Yeah.
But people were crying because it was so beautiful that it was this. And there's this beautiful image where he's holding her foot in his hand and she's just floating. And then the lights go black. The audience had no idea what the backstory was. But I did that for my aunt. And it was very much that to immortalize her. It was just, but it was the only people who know are the people that I put in the cruise ship. There's like maybe 20 kids, 18 year olds, 20 year olds that are performing on cruise ship that would know the story behind each one of the pieces that I did. And that's like there was another song called Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night, I think is the song. I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah.
But you listen to the lyrics and I was like, oh, you're getting laid. So they're doing a duet on a
right.
hoop, and I'm like, guys, this is foreplay. This is, you know, you're doing
yes.
a deep. And then the very last moment when you're up in the air, that's the orgasm. So I want to see, I don't want you to be like literally showing the audience, but I want you to have that through line that you're hooking up, you're getting laid, but you're doing it in the air, you know? So,
right.
So it's just the way that I stylize my work so that the audience feels something that's nonverbal. They know that there's something emotional happening. They just don't know what it is, but they know they're getting this effect from the audience, from the performers. And that's the stuff that I've always been putting into my work. And I always teach yeah. that as if somebody wants to put a routine together for a showcase, or even if they're doing something professional, I always say throw story into it, because if there's nothing going on from here up, I'm just looking at you, you know, doing pretty are pretty moves acrobatically.
Yeah, do you think that's what a lot of these modern aerialists are lacking? I've never really thought about that.
Yep. Watch a couple of Cirque du Soleil's, and there are people there that you look at them, they're dead in the face. The face is deadpan. There's no emotion. There's nothing. They're concentrating on, oh, shit, I need to do my triple, or I need to do my double back right now. You know, unless they're one of the key actors in the scene or a comedian or what, you know, because circus has a whole other idea behind the way that they tell their story, but it's similar because each one of those characters has a backstory that the audience has no idea because they're not speaking English, they're speaking gibberish. And that was the other thing that was painful to learn about Cirque du Soleil, that they're not speaking a different language. This is a made up.
What? Language. Wait, that's a mind blowing thing.
Yes,
you're telling me.
Yes, I swear to you, there's a show called Zed that Cirque du Soleil did. One of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. And it was Hymn of the Worlds. No, not Hymn of the Worlds. I have to think about it right off the bat. I have to look on my phone. But in that song is this gorgeous soundtrack. It sounds like Celine Dion and Josh Groban are singing this beautiful ballad. Yeah. And then when you look it up, I'm like, I want to know what these words mean. It's gibberish. It's made up. There's no lyrics. It's just they make up this language. And when I found that out, I was like, because you're having such an emotional exchange on stage and you're really moved by it. And I'm like, well, what does it mean in English? You know, but it really means nothing.
Wait a minute. Is that in all the Cirque shows? They're just speaking.
Most all of them. Yeah. Most all of them. Yeah.
What?
There are a few. Alegria, the song Alegria is in Portuguese.
Okay.
Kidam, the song Kidam is in French. There's French and Spanish. But the stuff in Zed is all gibberish. Saltimbanco is all gibberish. And so it's like each different Cirque show has these songs in it, and then most of the time it's gibberish. Unless it's like the title song, are they making it up every time, or is it? No. They literally have a phonetic sound. Because they have to repeat the same song over and over again. So phonetically, it is the same lyrics but it means nothing. And and they have to fuel it themselves. So that makes the actor work harder to make this duet happen.
You know, I have to ask you, I definitely look, just because you have so much experience in showbiz and you've seen different phases of theater, I definitely want to throw some questions at you regarding that. And feel free to be as honest as you want. Let me start with this. Cirque, do you think they have an unfair monopoly on the way we perceive circus entertainment in this country?
Yeah.
Do what the unfair? Am I going to get you in trouble for this?
No.
Yeah,
what is going on
with Cirque du Soleil? Because I do. Look, when I go to Vegas, I want to see a Cirque show. I mean, they're such great shows. And even Le Rêve, which I know was somebody that was involved with Cirque and didn't want to do it under the Cirque umbrella, like, that was an amazing show to me. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to go to Las Vegas and I'm going to have a ton of money, I'm not going to gamble. I'm just going to see those shows all the time.
Sure.
So
that's a
there
surefire
is something
way
there.
To get your money's worth. Yeah. Here's the thing. The Cirque bubble is, you know, I've trained people for who've gone to audition for Cirque du Soleil who've been like cut before they even touch an apparatus. And these are people that are in terrific shape. They have beautiful skill set, you know, just gorgeous aerialists that have gone in and have just gone like, sorry, we're not interested. They have a mold. And, you know, they're very strict about flexibility. If your flexibility changes, like, they actually measure your split when you go to the ground. They measure if there's any distance between the ground and your body.
Wow.
And if by any chance you're coming back from an injury and you don't have that full 180 or full split, they can let you go or not put you back in the show, in the role. They're very, very meticulous about the type. There's a body type that they look for. There's also an androgynous type that they look for. So, and they also mostly cast younger gymnasts because they have the ethic, the work ethic to produce the tricks. They can give you the theater stuff after you get the tricks. But they want the tricks. They want the young body that they can use over and over again. And that's the nature of the circus. Now, in the old days, circus was run by circus families. So the circus acts that were in Ringling Brothers, Big Apple, all the older circuses, these were people that for 200 years, their families had only done circus acts. So there were 6-7 generations of circus family that would just roll over. And they were acrobatic, but they were charismatic because they watched the way that their grandfather did the flying trapeze. They watched the way their grandmother did cloud swing or hair hang. So they got that, and they never taught outside of the circus family. And you either married into a circus family as a circus performer, or you weren't trained. Like I was one of the, you know, when we started in 87, 88, the 6 people the 5 people that I started with, like that was unheard of. A circus family would never give up their secrets. They would never train a non-circus family person. And it was very much looked down upon whenever I would perform in different places where circus families were involved. They were not happy because somehow someone somewhere gave away their secret and I was taking a job away from them and that someone in their family. So
interesting.
You know, now those circus families all got scooped up by Cirque, but then they're also, you know, they don't get the same contracts. They don't get the same treatment, but Cirque just brings in, you know, they have their own school up in Montreal. L'École Nationale de Cirque is what feeds Cirque du Soleil. And if you get into that school, that's great, but it doesn't guarantee you you're going to get into Cirque. It's going to guarantee you you're going to get an amazing education in circus acrobatics. And so I, at an early age, because I started trapeze late, I was considered starting late. I was in my 20s by the time I started. So because I started late in that game, my life expectancy of an acrobat is, you know, 10 to 15 years. So still working at 50, I was still, you know, still working, doing acrobatic stuff, but the gigs had dried up. You know, there's only so many people that want to see an older person in the air. And, you know, and quite honestly, my body, you know, because of the rheumatoid arthritis and things over the years, you know, the last show that I did professionally was I did the Phish concert at Madison Square Garden on New Year's Eve in 2018. And that was the last. And I'm like, if you're going to go out with a bang, you know, performing at one of the biggest rock concerts of the year. At Madison Square Garden, being able to touch the ceiling 75 feet in the air.
So cool.
And that was like, I'm at peace with that now. You know, it's not that I don't want to do it again. I would love to, but with hip replacement, you just can't do that. But there is a formula that Cirque du Soleil has for what they hire and how they hire. And it's mostly they look, are you a gymnast? Are you a dancer? Great. Because we, you know, and then gymnast goes to the top of the line because gymnasts and dance go together. And so that's your acrobat. Now, the other stuff, they're very creative on on how they hire clowns and actors. And, you know, there's so many different little key moments in a Cirque show. And I remember I auditioned several times for one of the clown roles. And we did this thing called the presentation exercise, in which for 2 solid hours, I was in a group with maybe 30 people. We had to run to the table where all the casting, present ourselves and exit. But present, you could run, you could tumble, you could scream, you could dance, you could sing, whatever, you had to think on your feet. So they had but it was literally like this Cirque boot camp. And, and it really trains you to be, you know, to improv on the site, as far as that goes, because after you've gone through your 10 best tricks, you're like, oh shit, I don't want to repeat one. What do I do next? You know? And it was very interesting to see their casting process. But again, that was a long time ago. That was like the last time I auditioned for Cirque would have been 2005, I think. So, But the bigger shows that they have put people into before, they go through an arduous audition process for the act, for the actor, clown, you know, supporting characters, that kind of thing.
Do they
And a
pay
lot
them
of
well? Do they pay them well at all?
Yes.
Okay, so that's good.
They used to.
Oh,
From what
okay.
I hear now, the people in Vegas, ever since Cirque got bought by, I forget the name of the company. It was a Chinese company that bought. They bought the entire bubble and laid off 500 people. So right then and
Oh,
there, I
okay.
knew that there was something that was not going to be well. And I don't have all the inside information. I don't pretend to have the inside information. But what I do know from the people that I do know are still working, they make a living wage, but it's not what we used to make. You know, we you know back in back when I was performing on a regular basis, I could make 1500 to 2000 a week, back in the 90s,
Wow.
you know, doing nightclub work. And the mud shows would pay you by the act, and also would pay you to do extra work, and you could make a nice salary by performing, selling merch, or selling concessions. There was one show. I did my Spanish web act, which is a rope that spins really fast. Did my act, slid down the rope, took my bow, put my cape on, ran out, opened up concessions, and started selling in full costume and makeup, selling popcorn, peanuts, and lemonade in full costume. And I got extra money for that. And that was the old school circus way of doing it. Everybody puts up the tent, everybody feeds and washes the animals, and everybody, you know, works concessions, and that's how they are able to share the wealth. But basically, you're there to make the impresario rich.
Yeah.
And there, you know, there was a clause in almost every contract that says you must be generally useful. When I was like, that's very vague, sir. Can you explain what generally useful is? There were extra things in the contract called cherry pie, which is if you put up the tent, you get an extra $25. If you feed the elephants, you get an extra $10. You know, so there was a way that they could give you extra money to do different things. So.
This is yeah, no, what I really love about this conversation is you're taking me to the journey of circus life, which is partly why I was interested to really interview you talking about this. I'm curious how much does it match up with the Toby Tyler movie and the fantasy of it? There is something about running off as a kid, joining the circus and going on a train and traveling the country and meeting these odd people. And was it, did you ever encounter that kind of that idea?
Here's the thing. I've done so many nightclub was my jam. That was
Yeah.
where I made my coin in the 90s. So if I did a small stint here and there, I did 6 weeks on this show, or then I was just sort of brought in as the swing. I was always the swing in the
Right, right.
musicals. So I was always the cover. And I did the musical Barnum, and I covered 17 people, both male and female acrobats. So I covered whoever was out, I covered their spot because the acrobatic tracks were not gender specific. So that training of being able to, you know, shift on a dime, you know, that is how I live my life. So that's why I'm good at being a swing. When I was training to do different, to, you know, like the, when these little shows would pop up, they were they happened, and they happened so quickly that it wasn't like, oh, I've been on the road for years.
Yeah.
It was like I was on the road for a month.
Did you encounter any of those people that had been lifelong
Oh yeah,
travelers in the circus?
I'm still friends with a lot of them. The people that I got to know were mostly women. And because most of the men from circus families did not want to engage with anyone who was not a circus family person. The women were
Interesting.
more open to it. And most of the Mongolian women that I worked with were fascinated with red hair. They never, you know, in their country, they only had seen red hair, you know, as a dye job. They never saw someone who was a natural redhead. So that sort of opened up, you know, it's kind of like this
Yeah.
two-headed calf unicorn, you know, that
Yes.
so and then as you go through, now I'm friendly with more circus families than I was back when I was actually doing circus work. because they're a little bit more relaxed about it now. They're still training their kids, but they're more open to it because they, you know, some of the kids, one of the kids that I worked with back in the 90s, amazing Mongolian handstand, hand balance artist. At 7 years old, this kid was incredible. He had a six pack, he had muscles, he was doing all kinds of acrobatics. What does he do when he grows up? He leaves the circus and becomes a doctor. So, you know, that wasn't possible to, that wasn't even fathomable to a circus family back in the day. So, so now they're more open to it. And with the advent of Cirque du Soleil sort of shifting things, the other, you know, now it's anybody who has a good act, a flashy act, has experience can get into a show. Doesn't have to be a circus family anymore. But there are some circus traditions that really still are taboo to take over or give away. A couple of years ago.
Yeah, talk about that. I'm
somebody
curious.
Did a quick change act on America's Got Talent. And then all of a sudden, everybody's doing quick change and everybody figured it out or they watched, it is like a magician's secret. It literally is. It's when you, you know, like all magic is a lot of times is it's right in front of your eyes because it's tricking. It's just tricking your eyes, seeing where that came from. Or, you know, somebody goes into a bag and then they're wearing a ball gown, or they go into a, yes. Go behind a door and then they come out in another outfit. Very, very easy, but I won't be the one to break that tradition. But also like the hair hangers, they hang by their hair. They have to have long hair, but the knot that they make to stay up is very specific. And if they lock the door when they're making their knot, and they don't share it or teach it to anybody except a family member. That's one of the ones that's still guarded. People are trying to figure it out, but you have to be careful with that because you can really get hurt if you don't know the secrets. But I do know that is one.
That is so good. You are opening my imagination up so much right now.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Now that I'm on the other side of the acrobatic world, because, you know, my acrobatic life as a trapeze artist is gone because it's not coming back with a hip replacement. There's just no way that I can physically, not just physically, but I don't know if I want to go back and without the intensity, you know what I mean? Like I imagine I will be able to, cause I know people in the industry who was like, oh, I climbed after a year and I did a split in the air and blah, blah, blah. Like, you know what? I don't want to be the 60-year-old guy up there doing a split because he had a hip replacement and have everybody cheer because he's got a beer belly and a hip and a split. I don't need that.
Right.
I'm at peace with that. I'm at peace with being on the other side of it. And now it's like, and what next? And, you know, in writing the books, it was a very, very telling time for me because I really had to think, you know, I knew I needed hip replacement. And the reason that I put it off for 6 years was because my mom had moved in with me. Then she moved into a nursing home and I knew I would not be able to do the recovery time without being able to care for her, look after her. Even though she was in a nursing home, I still saw her virtually every day. I'm a mama's boy. I'll always be a mama's boy.
Yeah.
And so when I knew she was gone and then I was sick and when I started to feel better, I'm like, I think it's time. And then I was like, I think it's time. And then I just like, oh no, I'm going to hold off. After January 1, 2021, I was like, I got to go. I got to find a surgeon. I got to get this done because I can't walk without a cane. I was in miserable pain. Ugh. And now I don't even feel it. Like that's the weird part. Like it feels, it was so fucking crazy. Cause I'm like, I don't feel the hip anymore. It doesn't feel like I'm, you know, when I was really, really sore, I couldn't walk up the stairs without stopping to catch my breath or stopping to use my cane to get my leg up. Now I'm like I'm walking 3 miles a day and, you know, I'm back up to.
Are you still going to perform, you think?
Oh, well, I still do stand up and I still do impressions. I do singing impressions. Like I said, there's nothing more addictive to making people laugh. So for me, that's sort of a shift as well. And, you know, I've been testing out material and things like that. Also, ringmasters make really good money. So I could see myself doing that. But in the same breath, it's like I'm working on a show right now that's coming to Broadway in a year. And it's about female superheroes. It's called Super You. And basically, it's a rock musical where a young lady who is in a bad relationship draws these superheroes, and they're all part of her. And one of the characters, I designed her flying, and she uses a really cool aerial apparatus. And her name is Lola Touche. It's a perfect superhero name. And so that I've been working on for a while, but that's like an aerial sequence job that's coming up.
So you're still in the field.
I'm still in the field. I run a circus facility. I train acrobats. I've been off for a while, but that's like my skill set is I can get anybody from point A to point Z in the acrobatic world where trapeze, you know, is concerned for performance.
I have to ask you something. Can you tell me what went wrong with Spider-Man the musical?
A lot of things. When you have too much money and you don't put it in the right place, there's a thing in Vegas called a day shift and a night shift. The day shift looks at all the equipment. The night shift is the performance. So the night shift looks at it and notifies the day shift, hey, we need to change cable on Green Goblin, or we need to change cable on da da da. They didn't have a day shift. And so that was the first red flag. Also, there was no... I wasn't behind the scenes with that one.
I was going to ask you, could an aerial show in that space, the way they envisioned it, even safely happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It needed more time to cook. The book was there. The design was there, but there was so much money being put into it. And there were so many people that were like, well, if you take that character out, I'm pulling my investment. You know, there's a lot of weird stuff with investors nowadays where they have too much control. But where that's concerned, I just feel like there was, and again, I was not there. So, when things like that go wrong, that means that there's no oh shit time to put into what happens if what this scenario happens. You know, there were so many injuries that for something to have that many injuries, something wasn't right. And I fault the overproduction and someone not saying, hey, this isn't the way we do this. Yes, you want it to be this exciting, you know, thing with Spider-Man going this way, that way. You know, and there were some really incredible moments in the show. I will say Julie Taymor, the stuff that she did up to the time she was fired, the stuff that she put in the show, the masks and all that stuff was so cool. And the comic book design of the way that, you know, because it was sort of like once she left, somebody else took over and it was not the same. Mm-hmm. It's just like any other show when somebody, you know, when somebody takes on the director role or takes on the design role after somebody's already done most of the design, you don't mesh, you don't, your aesthetic is so different. And again, I saw it, you know, I was in the balcony and Green Goblin got stuck. And so what did he do? He basically did like a stand-up comedy routine talking to us, like 20 feet away from us, you know, and just like, and then you hear over them, God, Mike, please hold, you know, and then, okay, we're ready to go. And then he was like, back to the acting. And then boom, he's starting into the fight sequence again. So it was just like, you know, there were some really fun, there were really good moments in it. I just think it needed more time to cook. You know, it just was not ready for that. And the music wasn't bad, but it's Cirque du Soleil did a show on Broadway called Paramore.
Yes, yes.
Great, great acrobatics. Great acrobatics.
Okay.
The story, the music. I was like sitting there going, you're on Broadway. You have access to every composer that's out there.
Yeah.
You have access to every director that's out there. Why are you not picking a composer and director that have worked on Broadway to do this Broadway show? And so because true. when you put theater together with circus, there has to be a through line. There has to be a reason for somebody to hang from the chandelier. You know, if there are people hanging from the chandelier, you know, you just sing a love song and then all of a sudden there's two girls doing contortion on the chandelier. You know, it's not the Celine Dion concert where the piano yes. floats across the stage. You know, it's like Broadway audiences are not stupid. So you have to give them that background. And, you know, with the things like Spider-Man, you know, everybody loves the spectacle of the musical. And that's why they were pumping so much money into it. They thought, oh, the kids are going to love it. We're going to sell the dolls. We're going to do this. And you can't fool Broadway. You can't fool a Broadway audience by cutting corners on those details. That's why I keep saying details.
I know. And story is the through line of this interview too. Just always going back to story.
Yep.
What is happening? Why is it happening? You're so right. If nobody wants to see the most talented singer in the world that nobody's heard of singing a song on a piano and people doing aerial acrobatics, because it just, there's no context. Nobody cares. Yep. I don't care how good you are, right. But you do see that a lot at these spectacle right. shows.
Celine Dion singing, I think she was singing My Heart Will Go On, and there's a Cirque du Soleil clown on a piano just floating over her head, like just for no reason. Now, granted, Celine Dion, you're paying attention to Celine, but all of a sudden you're looking at like, why the fuck is there a piano in the air? You know, you know, that it for that genre, it worked because she is Celine Dion. She
exactly.
is multi-talented. She, you know, she's selling, she's the one you're looking at. That's just scenery. And yes. that, you know, when it comes down to like, there was something I saw to, before the pandemic, I saw the musical Six, and it's about the six wives of Henry
VIII. Yeah, it's coming back.
So clever, so creative, very short. It's a one act, hour and 15, 20 minutes. But it was brilliant in the way that it was designed, and they are each telling their story and stuff like that. You didn't need like flying sets or anything like that for that story, because it was about the six wives and how they navigated that crazy time. And it was also, you know, very empowering for women that, you know, these six women are taking back their stories is right. kind of like the idea. And then I saw Frozen, and the one thing that made me just gasp, and you can see it on the internet, is she has a dress transformation that is one of those quick changes that we've learned about. And in the middle of the song, Let It Go, the stage fills up with smoke and there's ice going everywhere and there's glitter and everything. And all of a sudden she just opens her arms and the dress disappears in yes. front of your eyes. And, you know, I know how it's done because I can make those dresses, but for that moment, when you suspend reality, it was just like, you can't buy that kind of excitement. And yes, it's with a multi-million dollar musical, it's a multi-million dollar, billion dollar kids movie. You can't, you know, those theatrical moments that tell that story that were, you know, you're there for the story. You want to be taken away. You want to be taken away from your daily life. The day before my mother was sick, the next day they announced that we weren't allowed to visit nursing homes. And I got a $40 ticket for Frozen. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go see a Broadway show. I'm just yeah. going to go see it. And I sat there in the front row right next to the conductor and literally just was just, you know, just taken away for those 2 hours. And was it perfect? No, but somebody did their homework and somebody in every single scene was telling me the story you just have to give yourself over to it. And there are other shows that are out there that, you know, they have their gimmick or they have their concept. Whenever I was in a production meeting and the director comes to me and says the word concept, I always, you know, get hives. because that means that they don't trust the story enough that they have to manipulate with their mind this concept. You know, oh, we're doing cabaret, but it's taking place in a 1950s soda shop. You know, or you know, and like, oh God, please, what's the material? What? How could you possibly do that? And
yes,
why would you do that? It's like taking the Mona Lisa and putting a mustache on it. You know, but that particular type of theater, if the director has to work hard to put their stamp on something, then they're not doing their job well. That's just my opinion. And, you know, my job, if I was, I have directed, but it's just not something I love doing. But my job when I was directing was why are we here? And what are we telling the audience in these next 3 minutes, whether it's a song or, you know, Hal Prince could not have been more brilliant with the way that he strung scene into song. And when you looked at the old musicals, the really old musicals, you would be sitting there and you'd hear somebody sing an old song, and then they'd start the scene again, or the scene before that. But there was nothing that connected the song to the scene. It was just the action would stop, the song would happen, and then the action continued. Hal Prince tied them together and made it that the song took you from point A to point Z. And the same way, every time you turn a page, you're learning something new about what's going on in the story. And, you know, you shouldn't need all the bells and whistles to tell a story. I mean, but what sells Broadway tickets right now is bells and whistles. It's not all, it's bells and whistles, and it's reality show contestants, you know, that kind of thing.
I was going to ask, do you, you know, the state of the industry in terms of performers, I once put up something, I put up a Facebook status that got a lot of response from people, which was, you are now more likely to book a leading role in a Shakespeare show on Broadway if you were an Instagram influencer than if you've even read a play.
Yep.
In acting school. And people said, yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. I knew that we were in trouble when Nanny Leakes went into Cinderella as the wicked stepmother. And she's not a singer. And she's not an actress. There were a couple of Dancing with the Stars people that got thrown into the revival of Grease. And, you know, if I want to star in a Broadway show now, because I've been in the industry for so long, I would probably, if I were lucky enough to get cast, I would get cast as an understudy or chorus. I would never get a lead and that's one of the reasons why I self-published my books, because in all of my searching for an agent and things like that, the people that are doing cooking shows, the people that are selling cookbooks are Trisha Yearwood, Valerie Bertinerni, you know, all those,
yes,
they're all celebrities before, you know, now Paris fucking Hilton has a cooking show on Netflix.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. The woman never cooked a day in her life, but she has a cooking show. And that's one of the things that's why I was like, oh, self-publishing, I'll do it. Because if an agent wants to find me, and if an agent wants to get more work for me, they'll find me, but I'm going to, you know, no one's going to stop me from doing what I'm doing. But in the same breath with that, you know, yeah, one of the big dreams that I have that has not been fulfilled was performing on Broadway. You know, I've worked on Broadway, but I worked behind the scenes from a design point of view, from a training point of view, you know, that kind of stuff, but I've never performed on a Broadway stage. And so that, you know, it's like, I worked with Jerry Mitchell on the show Broadway Bears, and Jerry has a quote, and it's, dreams don't have an expiration date. And I truly believe that, hey, if I can self-publish my own two books, if I can become a trapeze artist after going to theater school, then why should I let go of the possibility that the right role at the right time could come up for me? Now, do I live my life waiting for that? No, you still have to do, you're still a creative person. Keep creating. Don't stop creating. That's one of the things that people have to understand. If you're creative, then it doesn't mean that you have to stop painting, or if you stop, that you have to stop doing circus. There are other ways to do those things. Like I said, like, I love doing impressions. I love doing singing impressions and stuff like that. That's been sort of my pivot from circus and theater. It's like, hey, jump into the stand-up world a little bit, make people laugh. And, that's exciting because I get to play. I get to play. Shakespeare called it a play because we're supposed to be playing. And yeah, that also is, you just because one part of your career is over or is you're unable to follow through with that doesn't mean that your creative life is over. And I feel like, those people that told you, in theater school, do something else, that's because they were worried about themselves, not worried about you. They should have been teaching you how to work in theater instead of telling you to get out of it. Because for me, I'm like, if you want to do it, then do it, but find the way to train every day, stay in the business, do showcases, get out there, be seen, but just don't give up. And that's my, that'll be on my tombstone. Don't give up, because, because I mean, I plan to be cremated, but that's another story. it really does give you the, it goes back to the fact that, a lot of times people unknowingly hurt people. And I had great teachers at AMDA, but I will say, some of the teachers in my lifetime, even, when I went to college first and then went to AMDA, but even some people that taught me back in the day, they had no credits, they had no experience, they'd never worked professionally before. So they can't teach me how to audition. So get a good audition coach, get a good acting coach, get in somewhere where you can feel comfortable and you can feel like you're getting results, and talk to people, the Barrow Group is one of the best acting schools in New York. Why? Because they remove all the bullshit that the other acting schools put on you, and they take away all of that heady bullshit, the sense memory, and you have to write down your 24-hour life, and oh, my character would not eat peaches. Why would I eat peaches? How do you fucking know? Does it say in the script that you don't eat peaches? If it says in the script don't eat peaches, don't fucking eat peaches. So
I do love it.
But that is what I would say to those people, and just don't give up.
Do you think there are people who I guess my question would be this: in a world where the influencer has taken over and they're now, again, fame is what attracts people, likes, follows, all this kind of stuff, having this audience, for people out there that really do just want to make the art, do you think there's still space for them, or there is a bit of a hopelessness, I guess, when you see people that should not be on stage in these big parts?
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Like I said, I don't even know why she's famous, but why was Nene Leakes a lead in a Broadway musical? Why?
I know.
Here I am. I've worked in theater since 1983, 82 somewhere. So why is this person on Broadway? And it's the state of the economy of Broadway, because the it's so expensive to go see a Broadway show now. You have to mortgage your house in order to buy a family of tickets.
Yes.
It used to be $60 was the most expensive ticket. Now it's like, I looked at tickets, they were like $587 for front row seats for Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
And I'm like, I when I looked at the prices, I was like, are they still looking for investors? What the fuck is this?
Right.
So. I feel like the producers are so scared of losing money that they want to make sure that they have a surefire hit. Something like Six, which is the material that is really what gave it this buzz. It really started as a small little thing, and then it got to be very popular in England, and then all of a sudden it was in Chicago, then it was on tour, and then it was coming to Broadway. And it was the show was what was popular. not the people in it, even though the people that are in it are fucking amazing. The people that are doing the girls that are in the Broadway version. But you know, something like, you know, there's I can't think of the name of the show right off the top of my head, but there's a show coming back that, they're clearly, they need to make money and they need to pay. And also everybody now that's opening a Broadway show lost a year and a half of income.
Yeah.
Every actor, every producer, every director, everybody lost a year and a half of income. Excuse me. So those people are trying to make back the money that they lost. So instead of charging $100 a ticket, well, now you charge $200 a ticket. So in order to fill those seats with people coming from Bismarck, North Dakota to come to New York, you got to put somebody that they're recognizable, and you know, reality television does put people out there. Like, and I was really surprised that it didn't do well, but the Go-Go's musical that had Peppermint starring in it from RuPaul's Drag Race. Now, I'm sure that, well, first of all, you have music by the Go-Go's, which if you're a Go-Go's fan, that's great. But, and if you were alive in the 80s and you knew all that music, that's great. But if you're a millennial and you've never heard of the Go-Go's and you know Peppermint, you know, yeah, from seeing RuPaul's Drag Race, so you're going to go see that show. I loved it, actually. It was, you know, because I love that world. But it didn't do well because, again, you didn't have all the pieces weren't in place. And then there are other shows that are coming up, like The Music Man. So everybody knows Music Man from their community theater back in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Yes.
And I call, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota, if you ever get a chance to go there,
whoever's listening from there,
go, because you know, you have to know the rest of the country. You can't just live in New York City. You can't live in Boston. You can't live in LA. You have to visit the rest of the country, because that particular town was one of my favorite tour stops, because the people there were so generous and so loving and so sweet. And I was like, you know, it becomes this funny thing, but there's a whole country between LA and New York, and you have to meet people in order to, you know, like, but the only way you can meet people is by being on television, because unless you're in the movies or in television, they don't know who you are. And when they come to see a show on Broadway, they're going to say, oh, Music Man, I did it in high school. We did it in community theater. I can't wait to see Sutton Foster and Hugh Jackman, Oscar winner, Tony winner, bang, we're going to Broadway.
Yeah.
So of course that show's going to sell really well because people are going to come see it, but also they have a higher ticket price now because producers lost a year and a half of sales. So they're trying to make back their money. You know, I don't begrudge anybody who's got $14, $15 million that they're going to plunk down into a Broadway show. You know, if you have the money to invest in that and you want to do that, great. But they also want something back in return. So it's got to be a wise exchange. You know, when you do get into those things, like the show Wicked was famous in the beginning because of the two leads, but then the show took off and it was such a recognizable story that it really didn't matter that who the leads were. But the leads were always really good performers. Like one time I went and it was Rue McClanahan as Madame Morrible, and you know, you had Idina Menzel as the original Elphaba Witch, and Kristen Chenoweth. These are people that are, you know, multi-award winning actresses stepping into these roles. Joel Grey, Ben Vereen, you know, so it was like a revolving door of celebrities to keep that interest, not only in seeing the show, because some people are just coming to see the show, but when they see, oh my God, that's Ben Vereen, that's Chicken George from Roots, 1970s, you know, or that's Ben Vereen from Pippin, or that's Ben Vereen from da-da-da, or that's Rue McClanahan from the Golden Girls, you know,
yes.
That kind of a thing was how that machine worked. And the musical Chicago has like that revolving door of stars. And Chicago's been running 25 years. And every 6 months, there's a new lead. There's a new Roxy, a new Velma, or a new Mama Morton, or a new Billy Flynn that is somebody from, you know, and that was another thing too, like, when I saw Jerry Springer getting a role in a Broadway show, when I saw, you know, that those moments are, you know, it's like you have to go to your imaginary friend and be like, did you see that? fucking NeNe Leakes is in Cinderella and Jerry Springer is in Chicago, you know, and I'm sitting here going, I can't get fucking arrested on Broadway, you know,
yes. Like,
but that's the gripe that most theater professionals have, you know, that are actors in this. And I'm not auditioning regularly. When something comes up, like, I'll tell you the secret. I'm auditioning for the Harry Potter play for the Ron Weasley role. But that, I haven't auditioned in like 6 years. I haven't had something come up that I had to audition for. This just came out of the blue, and I'm like, hey, maybe it is. Maybe it'll be my time. But and you can edit that out if you want. But no,
you'll
my,
be great.
My point is though, if something comes your way, that's great. But we've fought so much to get into a union, to get on stage, to get be paid to be an actor, and then you see these people that, you know, were paid weekly to throw drinks at each other. Or, you know, like now I'm seeing like the girls from Flavor of Love are, you know, it's like they're back too. Like, Jesus Christ, I thought we put Flavor of Love off the map, you know, but like those kind of reality show stars are sort of resurfacing as actors, you know, and just because they have that following doesn't make it a good show. It just means that it's your chance to see a reality show performer in fucking Cinderella.
Yeah.
But
so I think the thing is that I'm getting from this, at least hearing that, you know, sort of what I'm reading between the lines is that this is the way it is. It's just gonna, this is how it's gonna have to be in order, based on the economy, based on the way theater works, based on attracting audiences and being commercially viable. You do have to bring these people in. However, sure, someone like you sees that doesn't just have to be the one outlet of your creativity. You figured out other ways. Like, even within the career itself, there are pivots. Writing an original web series, doing stand-up, writing this book, the ability to harness that creative spirit even when the circumstances don't allow you to break through to the top tier because of the economic restrictions.
Right.
I mean, the fact that you're telling me in this interview that you're still out there auditioning for Broadway shows and you're not letting these Paris Hilton having a cooking show bring you down and stop you means that there is a creative spark that is... It's just, you can't take it out.
No.
It's not going to go out, no matter what.
In the circus, we call it having sawdust in your veins, you know, because they put sawdust in the ring so that when the elephants shit, they can clean it up quickly. But it's like there's sawdust everywhere backstage at a circus, the old school circus. But it's the same thing with theater. Like, I'll never stop loving theater, and I'll never stop creating. It's just, you know, even my cookbook, I wrote a one-man show based on the cookbook. You know, where I tell the story while I'm making my grandma's sauce. So it's like, it's just the set. It's a one piece set. It's my kitchen. And people are just going to hear me talk about my crazy Italian upbringing. And, you know, so I knew that each time I made something, you know, who knows what shit my mama says will bring up. Maybe I'll do something where that, maybe I'll do a one man show about my mom or about her, you know, or maybe it'll be a play. Maybe it'll, you know, who knows? But I know that I'm not going to stop just because someone like NeNe Leakes is in Cinderella. Now I keep picking on NeNe Leakes. I don't know who that is. I've never seen any of the Good Housewives. I honestly have never seen one. But the commercials are a turn off to begin with.
It's yes.
Like, oh no, she didn't. You know, nothing. nothing. You know, I don't need to know that. You know, and it's like, let's take glorified people, glorify bad behavior, and put it on television for a buck. You know, that to me, and I worked in reality TV too. I've been on 7 reality shows as an acrobat, as a circus performer. That was kind of the hook. And reality show producers are only out to push their narrative. If you are in their narrative and they need something from you, they will push you to get that back. I was on Wife Swap. The producer on Wife Swap was pushing me to argue with the swapped wife of my student's mother, basically. My student's mother was swapped. with a pig farmer from Nevada. And so the pig farmer, sweetest lady on the planet, was sitting there, and they kept trying to get us to argue. And I said, there's an 11-year-old girl 20 feet in the air. If I turn my back and she falls, that's on me, not you. I'm not going to get stuck in the middle of this stupidity where this nice woman is sitting here and you want me to argue with her. So I really, like, there were many different ways that that the producers of reality television really manipulate people so that they can get their storyline. And it doesn't matter. They've decided who the winner is before the show even shoots. They've decided what each challenge is going to be and who's going to go home before it shoots.
Wait, really? And they know The Bachelor all the time? They always know the person at
most
the end?
Of the, yeah, they have a pretty clear idea. And you can tell when the way that things are edited, you can tell how they're leading up to which one is going to end up being there, being the chosen one, the one to get the rose, the one to get the crown. RuPaul's Drag Race is like one of the most that the producers really do try to get. They try to needle those girls to fight so that they can get the narrative that they want. And
interesting.
Yeah. What was this? There was one dating show that I was working on where I had this one girl was trying to do trapeze as sort of her date to show the man that she was adventurous, and she was terrified. She almost peed herself. And so I talked to her and I got her, you know, got her like, listen, these ropes and this harness that you're in it can hold a baby elephant. Right. It's not going to break. You squeeze your hands and take a deep breath and jump. And she did. The producer was like, oh my God, he's the fear whisperer. That's what we're going to call you. Cut to the actual show. Cut all of the stuff that I did with her. The host is saying my words. And then she takes off. So I was completely cut, edited out. And they used the host of the show as the fear whisperer.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Sounds about right.
You know, we're in a... I know we're going way over time. I'm sorry.
No, this is a very fascinating, very interesting stuff.
But the idea that that somebody in reality television gets a starring role on Broadway has always bothered me because I worked so hard to get where I am right now, and quite honestly, these reality show people, they're in it for that quick buck. And then they're on to the next thing. We in the industry, people in the actual industry who work their whole lives get shut out because, oh, well, they decided that the fairy godmother is going to be this type of a role, but the stepmother that's going to be our revolving door casting. So we're going to get Sherry Shepherd. We're going to get Fran Drescher. We're going to get Nene Leakes. Fran Drescher, phenomenal actress, not a great singer, but she pulled it off beautifully. She was funny as shit because she's good at theater and good at television. Sherry Shepherd is not an actress. She's a stand-up and she was on The View for a couple seasons.
Yes.
Not a good singer, you know? So so when you do that revolving door thing, it doesn't say a lot about what product is going to be on stage. And then you've got all these other people in that show, the dancers who've worked their entire life to get into a Broadway show. And here they are being a supporting cast to someone who threw a drink at somebody in Atlanta, you know, it's what's wrong with Broadway right now, because every producer that's out there sees dollar signs whenever they see reality television. Although, you know, lately there's not a lot of reality shows on. So that's a good thing, because I just really want to get away from that. I want us to get back to the good old fashioned sitcoms from the 70s and 80s. You know, I want the Golden Girls back. I want, you know, the original intent of Three's Company and MASH, all those situation comedies that were really funny and well written, You know, that is what TV should be. And then glorify those people because
yes.
they've gone into they because they've made us laugh on television. That's what the usual that was the format. Like you would go see John Ritter in Music Man at the Pocono Playhouse, you know, or Joyce DeWitt in Gypsy. You know, you saw all these people from that time period doing theater because on the off season, what did you do? You did a couple of months on Broadway doing, you know, whatever the show was. But people came to see you because they saw you on TV. And that's what is in the producer's mind.
Yeah.
You know, producers are there to make money. They're bankers. They're not theater people. Most of them are bankers. But, you know, there are really good producers out there that are passionate. When my mother died, the producer of our musical is coming next year, Super U, the producer called me. And she picked up the phone to call me. Now, I had worked with her maybe once during a reading, but she took the time to be connected with me on a personal level. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about theaters. Are you okay? Is there anything I can do for you? These big time producers that are out there, they don't care. They don't know your name, you know? And that was one of my gripes too. It's like, if you have that much power in this production, you need to know my name and you need to know my value. And with Melissa Jones is her name. She's brilliant. She was one of the producers on Jagged Little Pill as well. But you have a heart, but you also have blinders on for what the show is. But she really, that she broke that mold because I always had thought, and Rose Caiola is one of the most amazing people on the planet. Broadway producer, and she, like, human. Loves people, talks to people, gets people excited about the, you know, but there are some that are just bankers. And yeah. that's where, you know, unfortunately, Broadway's expensive. And it's expensive to do sets, costumes, and it's expensive to have crew, it's expensive to have ushers. You know, so you can't eliminate those things because they're what make theater magic happen.
Yeah.
So, but I was really, that was something that really moved me was when Melissa called me. And
yeah.
And that, you know, she even called me when I was in the hospital with my hip replacement. She's like, I'm around the corner. I can come visit anytime. You know, and I was like, oh my God.
I'd like to think in general, I think we're becoming more conscious as business people. And I think in light of everything that happened with the pandemic and you know, the racial injustice in this country, I think inclusivity is, in some ways, it is a buzzword. But I think there is a lot of the glass ceiling getting shattered with people that are producers that you would never have been in a conversation with, rich white male producers anymore. I mean, and even on television, it's always refreshing to me when I see created by female name, episode right. written by female. Like, I see it in TV all the time, more than ever right now. And I can't imagine theater isn't going to, there might be a world where it's the artists that are the business people.
Yeah. I do think that there is a shift happening. You know, the Scott Rudin issues that came up recently.
Yes, yes.
You know, and that, you know, that's just a drop in the bucket with the other producers that are out there that have, you know, they have to worry about those skeletons that are going to come out of their closet. Because that is definitely a problem, but there, you know, like I said, there are good producers out there. There are good people out there still working in theater. You know, but they also have bills to pay. So they have to do what they can to, you know, maximize their income to live at the lifestyle that they're accustomed to. So I can't begrudge them. Yes, you're a millionaire. That's great. Yes, you want to stay a millionaire. I get it. You know, I also want to just make a living. I want to be paid a living wage. I want to be treated like a human being.
Yeah.
So there are definitely some, you know, there are definitely some producers out there who don't follow suit like that. And I've had experience with great impresarios in the circus as well. But for the most part, they're rich guys who want to get richer. So that's what they do. They buy a circus. It's a machine. It runs itself. You just collect the money and try to make as much money as possible.
Yeah. How can we you as much money as possible? That's we got. I mean, that's what we got. BobbyHedglandTaylor.com, which you could learn more about Bobby's work. But we also have this book of yours that's out. Yes. Not that I know you're probably not doing it for the money, though I'm sure it helps. But yeah, no, hashtag shit my mama says. I mean, talk a little bit more about this book and actually, what are you trying to achieve with it?
Well, my mom brought such joy to people. And every time I posted shit my mama says hashtag, I would get so many messages from people and they would be, I feel like I know your mom. Thank you for sharing her with us. She makes me laugh every day. I can't wait to see her the next one. And then, you know, when she passed, people, you know, I had 300-400 emails and text messages and voice messages. And they were like, I can't believe she's gone. I hope you write these down. I hope you have them to save. And I was like, I'm going to share it with, and it's a small book. It's not like an encyclopedia. It's only 94 pages and, you know, it's not going to break the bank. It's under $10. So I knew what it was going into it. You know, I know very much both of my books are it's my vanity project. That's my art. So that's who I am, you know, you know, if somebody picks it up or somebody, you know, picks it up and reads it and gets a chuckle, crack, heroin. That's my heroin. If I can share my mom with you and give you something to laugh at, something to chuckle about and take away from, you know, all the craziness that's going on in this world right now, then I've done my job and my mom is still alive. And this is my way of immortalizing her. And by memorializing her. And she was a spitfire. There was always laughter in the house. She was a little nuts, but you know, we all are. We literally talked every single day, as long as I can remember. And you know, it was about sharing that laughter, because I knew that you know, social media is not social. It's really not. You can put a post out and then, you know, get zero likes, but then 300 people have seen it. And then they're like, oh my God, did you hear what Bobby's mom said? You know, that kind of thing, you know? And my mother always put her phone in her bra. So I would go to visit her and I would always have to take the phone and look at if she had messages, if anybody called her. And I was like, Mom, where's your phone? She said, right here, between the only two suckers I can trust. And she that was Mom. And, you know, also anybody dealing with a parent who's in a nursing facility, who's got dementia, anybody who needs just a little bit of comfort. Because one of the things that I realized was that I wasn't taking care of myself when I was taking care of her. There's the old adage, when you're on an airplane, you put on your oxygen mask before you assist somebody else. And I wasn't putting on my oxygen mask. I was not sleeping. I was sleeping in a chair next to her in the living room so that if she got up to go to the bathroom, I would walk her to the bathroom and walk her back because she would fall. And then, until she got into the nursing home. And then I was there visiting her almost every day. But it was about sharing that experience of who she was, and it's my way of just sharing her. And like I said, she's it's a little book with a big heart is the way that I wrote on the back of it. And I actually, the proof was just delivered by Amazon. I just got a text that the proof is downstairs.
Oh my gosh, congratulations.
So and it's on Amazon now. I think it's $8.99 on Amazon. It's a paperback book. It's 94 pages. You can read one page a day and get some Mary Lou wisdom. And some of them are short, some of them are longer, like me trying to explain to her what a drag queen was and why, and where they put the thing, because in RuPaul's Drag Race, you learn all about tucking. So I had to explain to her about that. Not that I've ever done drag, and I love drag queens. I love anybody in that art form, but it is not for me. It's way too much work, you know, but like little things like that, you know, like she would just blurt stuff out, you know, and it was always just, you know, It was always just something off the cuff and funny because she had a coping mechanism, and her coping mechanism was humor.
Yeah.
And when we were growing up, there was always humor in the house. She always had stand-up comedy on vinyl. She always had Joan Rivers, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, Robin Williams, you know, all of these, Whoopi Goldberg. She loved Whoopi Goldberg, but she would memorize them. And she had these so many, and she would just snap out these jokes that weren't even hers, you know, and people loved her because of that. And, you know, so I have sort of adopted that. That's sort of my way. My way of, you know, sharing with people is by making people laugh.
I know. And I really want to ask for an impression before this interview ends. I don't know. I mean, what can you? Well, look, you mentioned Eric Cartman.
I usually warm up. I usually warm up, but I can't right now. Seriously.
It's all good. It's all good.
Eartha Kitt is somewhere in the back of my throat. There's a and, oh, Euphigenia Doubtfire, dear, here with you today, Mr. Bornstein, a nice Italian boy.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, so they run the gamut. You know, they're fun. And they're
Do you have any, is it anything on YouTube? Any of your stuff?
I have let it go on YouTube a couple of times. Yeah, I'm working on two things. I'm doing a full Stevie Nicks set because I have Stevie Nicks' voice down. And then I'm doing a funny version of Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up.
Oh, amazing.
So that one was funny because I was working on Elvis and I found Cher. And then when I was working on Cher, I found Rick Astley. So I was like, that when I'm doing these voices in my head, they all sort of come out of different places. But Cher was enamored with Elvis. That's why she sounds like him. So
yeah.
And also, like, Rick Astley comes from that time period, too, where Elvis was huge. And that style of singing, that hollow kind of a low, down there in the back of the throat. But, you know, that I also have a coach that's brilliant. Christina Bianco is her name. If you ever get to see her, she's a YouTube sensation where she does like 40 voices in one song. And she's fucking brilliant. But yeah, so, I'm working on, you know, in stand-up you have a 5-minute set, 12-minute set, and then 15, 20, and then you have your hour show. So I have a 1-hour show that I'm working on called Bitter Party of 46. Cause I have 46 voices right now. I'm up to 50, but I might do, you know, I like the number 46. But each part of it is, you know, something from the 70s, like Kermit the Frog here, coming to you live from Astoria, Queens, you know, and each one would break into something different about, you know,
I love this
in the 70s. So,
yeah,
but I'm having a blast with that because it doesn't involve circus, but it's something that can be in a variety show.
Yeah.
And it's recognizable and it's,
I want to see it. You know,
I'll send you the link to my,
I'm a big fan of vaudeville and old timey entertainment and stuff that isn't Chekhov. And,
right.
You know, that was my problem with going to acting school. I went to school and I really just loved I went to NYU, studied at Stella Adler.
Okay.
So yeah, no, when you said, you know,
did you train with Eliza Ventura?
I don't know. I don't think she was there at the time.
Yeah, she was one of my teachers at AMDA, but she taught at NYU.
Yeah.
Very, very, very old school actress.
Yes.
Definitely the Uta Hagen type. But,
right.
You know, knew what she was doing, but you didn't want to mess with her. She was definitely one of those teachers that was like, this is this is a tough lady. Because she would just say, get off the stage, you suck. And, you know, she didn't like Richard, literally, like she would do, you know, she would be a little bit kinder than that. But that's basically what she was
saying.
That's
so good.
Like, get off the stage, you suck.
You
know, but there. But so that is, like I said, that's like crack to me, hearing someone chuckle, hearing me, you know.
I'm so glad you've held on to it despite your circumstances, and you're still finding the pivoting mentally, pivoting in terms of physically, pivoting in all the different aspects of your career. You know, it's been a very, very enlightening conversation. Some really
Nice to chat with you. I really, like I said, I really like.
Yeah.
I love doing these podcasts because it does a couple of things for me. It helps me get in front of another person that I've never met to share my story. And also to make sure that I hit hit the specific spots to tell the story. Because then if you leave out a detail, then someone's like, well, what do you mean your first words were fucking reindeer and your mom told you that you were conceived on a beaver dam? You know, tell me that story. How does that happen? You know,
wait, I don't know if we got to the beaver dam part.
it's in there. But yes, my mother told me, you know, she's like, I knew when I got pregnant with you, I was like, your father and I did it on a beaver dam. We were on a camping trip. So, and it's funny because these stories, like, you know, I don't know if they're 100% true, but I also know that I checked in with other relatives. I'm like, did mom ever tell you? Like, oh yeah, she told us the beaver dam story. And I was like, oh my God. No. And actually we have our old movies, our home movies. I had color. I had moved from Super 8 to VHS and then to digital, and going through them, and there's a cabin, there's a lake, and a beaver dam. So then they were filmed before I was born. So, yeah. So, you know, whether it's true or not, I just loved hearing the stories from her, and the more I tell them, the more people laugh, the more they get to know.
I love it.
She was a really special lady.
Yeah. Well, look, we're definitely going to help you get this out there. Bobby Hedgeland Taylor, thank you so much for coming on the show again. Thanks for having me. This is fantastic. Love it. Bobby, thank you so much for coming on the show. Everybody, check out #ShitMyMamaSays. Available now on Amazon. I'd like to thank Rodney McGilvery for the theme music. I'd like to thank you for listening. And, of course, follow me at TheGregBornstein on Instagram. Would love to hear your thoughts on this episode. I would so much rather have an international circus Olympics than any of this swimming sleepery. Yeah, whatever. I guess I just like clowns. Talk soon.